This week's episode of Screen Talk is sponsored by Amazon Studios presenting Borat's subsequent movie film. Sacha Baron Cohen's satire on Trump's America follows Borat to America to deliver a gift to then-Vice President Mike Pence. Now nominated for 3 Golden Globe Awards, including Best Picture and Best Actor Sacha Baron Cohen, a Screen Actors Guild Award for Outstanding Supporting Female Actor Maria Bakalova, and 2 Critics' Choice Awards nominations, including Best Comedy, streaming on Prime Video. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And as usual, in this time of year, even in a weird sort of calendar for award season, there are certain reliable pockets of time where some news actually comes along that we can really dig into. And for weeks, readers have been asking us, and listeners as well, what's going to make the cut on the shortlist? What has a chance? What should they be prioritizing? Well, now we have the answer. We have both the documentaries, we have the animated shorts, we have the international films, we have songs, lots to dig through. And the great thing about it for us was that we had a lot of time to dig through it before the rest of the world found out, because we got it under embargo. Tell me this, having seen this process in the past, is it wrong to say that there are fewer surprises and snubs, as it were, than usual? Because when I looked at this, I felt like with so much anticipation, this kind of just felt like what we thought it was going to look like.
Well, I mean, one of the things that was different this year was that they've always, you know, for the last, for a while now, the foreign language side of the Academy, which is made up, you know, the best international film is made up of people from across the Academy voting. And this year they opened it up online all over the world. All you had to do was see 12 movies that were assigned to you and whatever else you wanted to see, and then vote and basically, you know, give points to the movies you like and so on. And they tallied all of that up, and there were 15, they expanded it to 15, and there was no executive committee, you know, weighing in on what those special saves were gonna be that they would add to the list made up by everyone else. So it's like everyone else now, docs have 15 slots, and now so does international. And so we were all a little bit curious what the look of that list would be, and it was fine.
Yeah, well, basically what you're saying is that process worked. It helped in a way to address some of the deficiencies with people not seeing the right things or some of the quirky decisions that are made at the last second. I mean,
it isn't this small coterie of sort of devotees who are being wined and dined by publicists in LA. It's not that list anymore. It's a much, much bigger list. And it you can tell that they did really well. I mean, there were some movies like Beginning or Preparations to Be Together for a Long Time, whatever the hell that title is.
Well, probably undone by the title, honestly.
Apples. You know, they were some very art film friendly, you know, movies that were left out.
Yeah, the Portuguese submission, which obviously
your favorite. Watch. Yes.
But I mean, those are the, you knew
those would have been executive saves.
But you knew stuff like that was going to be a tough sell. When you look at the international list, it makes a lot of sense. Of course, you're going to have the Netflix Mexican entry, I'm No Longer Here.
That was very popular, very popular.
And to see
another round is still the front runner.
Yeah.
Obviously. Dear Comrades is coming up very strong, the Andrei Konchalovsky, black and white Russian film. Surprising movie from him, Eric. I mean, a very feminist take on Stalinist Russia that surprised me. This is an old guard, you know, filmmaker who actually made movies in Hollywood as well as Russia. You know, he's been around.
Yeah, Konchalovsky.
Runaway Train.
Ingo and Cash, he was fired from that one. Yeah, he's a character, and this movie I think is striking because it doesn't feel like a film from an old master. I mean, it is a black and white movie about a
period. In a sense it does.
But I mean, it's
the perspective is different.
It's a very contained, involving piece of filmmaking, You know, it's not an old man's film. It's, you know, from a cliche.
No. And he adopts this, the point of view of this woman who thinks she knows how to be an operatic, and does, and her heart is wrenched out of her chest when her daughter gets arrested and she has to find her. Yeah, I was very taken with this movie.
Yeah, and another one that I was really happy to see on there was Collective, because as well as The Mole Agent, those two are the Oscar
submissions.
The docs.
The double nominees.
Coming off of Honeyland last year, being the first ever to score that nomination in two categories, it's really cool to see that trend continue. And of course, Collective has had that momentum going for a while. Mole Agent, I know, was one that fewer people were aware of for a while. So I don't know exactly.
I would argue that Mole Agent is the more likely film to finally make the top five.
Which would, of
remember
course,
remember that everyone's voting on these 15 now.
And that would be really exciting, because if, you know, it's not a Collective is a, you know, obviously
Collective is a great movie. Yeah. I admire it tremendously, but it is not as heart-wrenching. It's a head movie, and Mole Agent is so accessible and,
right. Well,
and
I was gonna beloving. Say, it's beloved. Accessible, but it's also unconventional for a doc in the sense that it's sort of, it's designed like a narrative. It feels like a detective movie.
Totally.
Something else. So that was really great to see. On the doc side, beyond that, there were some really interesting inclusions. I mean, obviously, it's nice to see that in addition to things we've been talking about, Dick Johnson is Dead or
Crip Camp,
to see that MLK is on there, Boys State, 76 Days, Painter and the Thief. These are all movies that
Painter and the Thief was a bit of a surprise, actually. I mean, we loved it out of Sundance and I championed it early, but I hadn't heard, it hadn't been getting a lot of the awards attention from the doc community. So I was delighted to see it make the list.
And obviously Time would be the one that's sort of the big movie there. So that one continues its momentum.
It deserves everything. It does.
And Welcome to Chechnya, that was fascinating to see that film got both
VFX
and VFX. And you confirmed that it's the first doc to actually get a VFX short.
You know, this is a case where the odd pandemic year is coming into play. It totally deserves a VFX nom, but it's unlikely that if it was up against Dune and some of the other, you know, Bond, you know, some of the big movies that would have come out, that it would have made it. And I'm delighted that they went that way. They put some very, very bizarre B movies on there that I hadn't even heard of some of these.
Yeah, that is kind of hilarious. It's like, well, we got to stick something in this slot. So why not Bloodshot?
It's like all they had was Tenet and Mank and you know, and Welcome to Chechnya, you know.
But it's great. I mean, the idea of VFX in that movie being motivated by the need to keep these, you know, these subjects anonymous for their safety is such a different reason to use VFX. And it's one that with Flea, you know, coming out
yes,
of
something. Yes, they used animation for that purpose.
So I think it's nice to see that. Hopefully it's not just because, you know, there was some availability. Obviously Tenet got in and all of that. I'm curious about Soul, having an animated film. I mean, the idea of VFX in an animated film is,
well, that's a sign of the pandemic also.
Yeah,
you know, that, I mean, if Soul remains one of the biggest, most expensive movies along with Tenet released in this weird year, and therefore it rises up in it deserves any attention that it gets, but we'll see. I'm curious. I mean, Bill Deswitz, who covers crafts for us, he and I were debating whether Soul would make it into the VFX top five. It's hard to call. It's sort of unprecedented.
Yeah, I think that with VFX being what it is this year, it's going to be interesting to hear these conversations come out and how these campaigns take shape. I mean, are people now going to make time for Love and Monsters or any of that kind of stuff? No surprise that Midnight Sky is in there. Obviously, you've done that story. So, but then makeup and hairstyling, I think, is worth looking at as well in that respect, because I mean, it's nice to see Birds of Prey, which is such a fun, exuberant movie to look at. You could watch it with the sound off, and it would be a fun experience.
That was over Wonder Woman, which is sort of, you know, bizarre. Again, Bill and I were talking. He thinks that there has been some debate about the decisions that Viola Davis made in the hair and makeup department for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, where she went really authentic and kind of over the top. And this shows that the branch is supporting that decision, that big is good in this case. Well, so that could be the front runner.
Everything yeah. Viola in that movie is the best thing about that movie. So that makes a lot of sense to think.
Along with Chadwick Boseman.
No, I mean, it's a very strong performance for him, and he's the front runner for that category. But I mean, the performance, she gives such a loud, in your face, memorable turn. It's like, of course, it's going to trickle down to the craft side of what contributed to that performance. It's also funny to me, you have stuff like Hillbilly Elegy, which nobody really said was a good movie, but.
But the makeup is impeccable, and Glenn Close brought her own people in and did a great job.
And then
she's in the running still, Glenn Close. This is what you learn from this.
Glenn Close versus Maria Bakalova. Nobody would have predicted that race, but it seems to be
Glenn Close versus Olivia Colman again.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if those two actually get along. It'd be interesting to find out. But then the other thing in this category that we were talking about earlier was a nice excuse to revisit a film that really got completely ignored last year by most people, and that was Pinocchio. You know, because that movie, we liked it, and we saw it in Berlin.
It's such a beautiful craft. All the crafts on Pinocchio are just so impeccably, beautifully executed, it's real. It's prosthetics. It's tangible.
It's a throwback, but it works really well in that sense. It's got this handmade kind of gothic fantasy quality to it. And what's cool about it is, you know, this is a movie that came, it was actually very successful in Italy, and then went to Berlin, and buyers didn't really know what to do with it. And then Roadside is like slowly getting it out there. And I think that this could maybe help reintroduce it to people. So that's actually a nice way to see that a crafts category can actually advocate for people to watch a movie for other reasons. I mean,
which I love Pinocchio. Yeah.
It's not going to crack the performance categories or something, but maybe people will check it out. It's all, and look at the original song, the prevalence of Jingle Jangle. Who would have thought?
So Netflix did this extraordinary push. And what they do is they go for every little possible thing. And you have to hand it to these people. There were two, not only did they get three nominations for Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, which is a musical fantasy they got more nominations and from them, and then they had something like 19 movies and 26 slots in the shortlist, and it's just and even in the short categories, there's a song that there are two John Legend songs. So part of it, imagine that Netflix is sort of like the children, Lisa Tabak, who we admire and respect, comes from the Weinstein Co. universe. And the people at Netflix are really good at figuring out, okay, if we pick up this short with Sophia, what would Sophia Loren do? It will promote our Sophia Loren movie, The Life Ahead. And it got nominated. And it's a charming little short, but it's totally a Sophia Loren,
it's a great sort of synergy approach. Yeah.
Totally. And then there's this Giving Voice, which is this little doc short that's about people auditioning for August Wilson plays that is totally promoting Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And that got a nomination for song for John Legend. So they hire John Legend to do the songs. They know he's going to get nominated, nominated, but shortlisted.
Yeah. I got a weird thing in the mail. You know, all this swag, a lot of it is I tend to recycle it right away because I'm just not somebody who's going to use all these things. But Amazon sent this hilarious little box. It was like a YouTube speaker for All In, and then a little card saying, listen to this song. I didn't listen to the song. I just like tried out the little Bluetooth speaker.
That's the Janelle Monáe song, right?
Yeah, but
turntables.
I hear it's good. Yeah, so that was very smart. That kind of campy. You could see that.
Well,
that
kind of invested. This is what Netflix did. Does it look? It looks like this.
If you're just listening, Anne is holding up a giant speaker, which seems to have found a permanent spot next to her computer. And that's exactly why these kinds of things matter. They remind
swag. Me. What can we tell you? But the purpose of it is to listen to the music that they have up for grabs. And so if we get it, so do other people. Believe
we
you.
Have to acknowledge probably the weirdest entry in this category, which is not Jingle Jangle. I mean, I didn't think that was a great movie, but I'm not surprised that music got in. It's The Wuhan Flu from Borat, because that's a song. I mean, as always with these things, if you just listened to this song and had no idea about the context of it, that it was, he's playing a racist bigot performing for a bunch of gun nuts, you'd say this song is super racist and problematic. The satiric context of the song is essential to understanding it, which is why it's fascinating that it is on, I mean, I got lyrics to this thing in the mail with musical annotation and stuff. Hopefully they're not saying, sing along with us in this, but it's a pretty complex form of satire. So it's fascinating that it can get this far.
Well, the Eurovision Song Contest song got in also, which is another, if you like, comedy song.
Right. It's sort of making fun of songs like that, these very over the top.
But those are all, what I like about those two songs is that they're integral to the movies that they're in, and they're part of the narrative of the movie, and therefore actually perform a function, as opposed to, you know, a credit song. So the music branch gives them points for that.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. So it'll be fun for us to kind of pick through these over the next few weeks and advocate for them, because when I've gleaned from talking to Academy members and in a wide range of contexts, some of them are friends, sometimes for interviews and so forth, is that people are really kind of digging through things and looking for reasons to sort of whittle down their list. And this is a form of curation that will do that. So the next few weeks will be fascinating because everybody has that app, that Academy app. You know, it's
there's two songs by Diane Warren, this woman who's been nominated 11 times, you know, and
so
never
you
won.
Just vote for her because of that. Well, you
she's
have
a really good songwriter. I'm not dissing her per se, but
you just have to remind people, is it her time for the
that's song? Sometimes how it works around here.
If you don't have a Lady Gaga in the race, I mean, that's sort of the challenge, right? It's overcoming those.
At least they didn't nominate Justin Timberlake this time. No, I keep using the word nominate. These are shortlists.
Shortlists, yeah.
The final nominations are still to come.
But they are short, much shorter list than we would have otherwise. So it does make a big difference in that respect. What was a blind spot for you on the list? I mean, what kind of gaps are you planning to fill?
Oh, by the way, on the doc side, I was surprised that Netflix got a slot for My Octopus Teacher,
that
which
would
is
be
the
my
kind
goal.
Of mainstream, incredibly manipulative, you know, emotional. I mean, it's a huge hit on Netflix. Everybody saw it. I guess what struck me, and one of the reasons why they got so many slots, is not only they have a great number of movies and a great number of awards people working hard, but people watch Netflix. I mean, it's the bottom line. Do this, you do this late at night. We've watched our allotted movies of the day, and we, you know, look for stuff to watch. Did I watch the Sophia Loren short at 1 o'clock in the morning on a weekend? It was on Netflix.
I haven't seen that one yet. The Octopus movie was my blind spot. And the day that the shortlist dropped, I went and watched it and did not think it was a very good movie, which is unfortunate because as a nature lover and on many different levels, I thought it was doing something valuable in terms of appreciating the sort of intellectual capacity of an animal and what it takes to understand that. But it just anthropomorphizes it in this really crass way, I thought.
The narration is so overwhelming, and it's telling
it's
you.
It's a single source movie. He is the only voice in this movie talking about his relationship with this octopus, which, by the way, definitely feels strangely sexual and is not assessed in those terms at all. And neither is his life. I mean, what is going on? Where's the guy's wife? Is this a midlife thing? So it's underdeveloped. So I did think it was notable that was something I hadn't seen, and then the shortlist came out, and I was easily able to just pull it up on Netflix. And
it's really unlikely to make the final five, I think.
But I love this list overall. I mean, Dick Johnson is Dead, amazing movie. Goonda, an experimental.
I'm very glad.
I mean, that is the animal movie. It's Goonda.
Kosakowski. Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix promoting it. Yep. Absolutely.
And then Inferno made the cut. Inferno, which a lot of people probably haven't seen yet. And
so, that one made the cut on the doc side, but not on the foreign side.
Italy. Well, I wonder about that because it's, yeah, you know, the filmmaker is Italian, but it's not an Italian film in its bones in terms of what it's about. And I wonder if that maybe may have been part of the process on some level. And certainly it is an incredible piece of documentary storytelling.
I think it's extraordinary. To it. And I'm glad it got into the doc.
Yeah, in another year, perhaps, where we didn't have the collective mole agent side of things, this may have been another one that could have had a shot at having both of them covered. But people should make sure to check that one out. And then 76 Days, obviously, is the pandemic movie that had a very strong campaign by MTV Documentary Films behind it, starting since they acquired it.
That was a late-breaking one.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that it worked out. It's a must-see. It's extraordinary. And it's hopeful.
Yeah, so the next several weeks are going to be quite fascinating in that respect. But in the meantime, we also have some film festivals coming up. And this week, as I noted on our staff call, I said, you know, I'd like to think that the film festival news is the thing that everybody's going to be really talking about from the film world this week. But I'm pretty sure Shortlist will be driving the news cycle, and certainly they have. But we got a lineup for South by Southwest, and we got a lineup for Berlin, which means that over the next month and a half, we're going to get a whole bunch of different movies that are, you know, new reviews of movies worth talking.
Explain to everyone how they can be part of these festivals. What do they have to do to watch some of these movies?
Well, let's start with South By, because Berlin is a little trickier, but South By Southwest, usually you buy a film pass or you buy an interactive pass or a platinum pass. You can get different levels of engagement with that festival because it's not just one thing. It's film and music and interactive. This year, it's just one pass. I think it's $100-something, but the price keeps going up. So if you're interested, now is the time to jump on it. And that pass gets you access to all these different channels. So it's very different from Sundance in the way that, you know, Sundance had this very specific platform for watching movies on a schedule. South By is going to have the same volume of movies. I think they have one more movie than the Sundance lineup, actually. But they're also going to have live music performances. They're going to have the conferences. So if you get that pass, what you can do over the course of the 5 days of this festival in the middle of March is kind of tune into different channels. You can watch a live show. You can then watch a movie on demand. You can watch a keynote. So you're going to be having that kind of South By experience more as a kind of a VOD experience. But I think it's actually a positive in some ways that one pass gets you everything, because in theory, that means more people are going to have a broader kind of experience with this convergence culture that South By has always been at the center of.
As much as I always like seeing the films at South By, it's actually some of the conference stuff that's most exciting to me. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean,
some amazing speakers in usually.
Yeah, I think the keynotes will be the thing to keep an eye on, though. I'm looking forward to digging into this lineup. It doesn't have the usual kind of big studio movies. There's no Baby Driver type of movie to anticipate, and based on my conversations with the festival, it doesn't look like they're going to have any, you know, surprise additions like when Ready Player One was a secret screening a few years ago.
They were used as marketing launches, so there's no reason for the studios to do it.
Exactly.
It doesn't serve their needs.
Yeah, which, you know, maybe that's
because of the pandemic.
But the thing is, those movies often played so loudly in the Paramount, and so it's just hard to imagine recreating that kind of noise for a movie through some sort of targeted VOD launch. So, okay, fine. But we still have 74 features. I mean, the movie the festival opens with this Demi Lovato YouTube series about her life overcoming addiction that supposedly gets into the pandemic. And it sounds like there's actually way more movies in the lineup this year that are response or a reflection of the past year in quarantine than Sundance opened up to. So I think we'll actually have a clearer sense of how filmmakers have chosen to incorporate these things into their narrative filmmaking, as well as a number of docs. And that's going to be sort of
book any of the Sundance movies that people can catch up on that had buzz?
I think there will be a few, like How It Ends, but not as many as usual. which is not surprising, obviously, because everybody has fewer films than usual. There are some films, I think, that have premiered at some other overseas festivals and so forth. Obviously, they're going to get more attention this time around. I mean, most of these movies, if you look at the narrative competition or the documentary competition, these are mostly first-time filmmakers who don't really have much of an imprint unless you've been watching short films that have premiered in places like South by Southwest. So there is this potential for discovery that's very strong here. And I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. I mean, sometimes with these movies, you know, you don't really know what you're in for until you watch them. But I mean, all the way through the midnight section, which has a rotoscoped animated heavy metal feature, there's so much stuff where I'm like, yeah, I would watch that and just see how it goes. And I love that kind of stuff.
And what about Berlin?
So Berlin is a very different situation because Berlin is basically saying that it is a online market in March with its selection available virtually at that same time. And then in June, they're gonna have a physical screening for each of those films they've selected. So there's like two parts to this festival. It's not gonna make the same kind of noise that a physical Berlin festival would have because really they're using the lineup to instigate market activity, but those films will still be reviewed and so forth. And it's a promising selection of the kinds of films you would see in Berlin in the sense that probably big international auteur-driven works for the most part are holding off for Cannes, except for maybe one or two that are realizing that in the context of Berlin, you can make a lot of noise if you're, you know, the shiny object. So case in point, Celine Sciamma has her new film, which, you know, does not look like a big starry movie, but since Portrait of a Lady on Fire, her profile has expanded tremendously. Sure. So that movie is something that obviously everybody's going to be looking out for. There's a Mexican filmmaker, Alonso Ruiz Palacios, whose last film, Museo, was the Mexican submission the year it came out. He's got a new movie.
I saw that. That's
very strong. So there's a couple, there's obviously a new Hong Sang-soo movie, and who knows, if maybe he's got a little pandemic element to it. You know, he probably made it last week. So there's that kind of stuff is always fun because it's an opportunity to check in with some of these maybe lower profile European art films that certainly will resonate with audiences, but just wouldn't make the same kind of noise that some of these other films do at Cannes.
So a couple people on Twitter were like, they got excited that French Exit was and then they thought it was French Dispatch.
Imagine. So
we are waiting for French Dispatch still, and the likelihood is that that will show up at Cannes, which is now scheduled for July as a live festival, and I have been nurturing fantasies of actually going, and I got my taste buds going when I watched the episode of Call My Agent that was set in Cannes.
I keep hearing about it. Yeah, so this show, I haven't watched it.
She wanders from the palais.
I can't believe they did that. Did they shoot it there?
All there. It's so powerful to just see it in all its, you know, you and I know every corner, every street lamp, you know.
An absurd thing to know.
Physical, the longing to actually be at Cannes.
I mean, this idea of having Cannes in July as they've locked it in is certainly intriguing because July is very soon. You know, it's not next month, but it's pretty soon, and a lot has to happen for the world
people
to convert.
Have to get vaccinated. Yeah. All the
borders have to open.
Set in. Yeah.
And it's just we're just not there yet. We're not just us, but France is not there yet. You know, other countries, Italy and so forth. So it's a real open question exactly how this is going to go. But unlike South by or Berlin or Sundance, which have found various kinds of virtual solutions, it's basically unthinkable that Cannes would go this route. I mean, there's just too many factors, not just Thierry Frémaux, it's the board of the festival.
It's the way they think about it. It's just the way it is.
Exhibition. Yeah,
they could do something like Venice, though. I mean, Venice was done.
They did it.
In that little window that was open, they did it.
And they're planning to do that again.
All Europe that could go.
Yeah. I mean, look, the fall is, everybody's is sort of raring to go. Toronto's got its dates locked. New York seems to be closed.
Telluride is the most likely place for us to show up.
It would be nice to know if they're locking those dates soon, but it certainly seems like that's a possibility. So I guess we have to just kind of play it by ear. I mean, if we jump into Cannes in July and then we get take our breather in August, it's not going to be much of a breather, because by mid-August we're going to be gearing up to go to Telluride. So it's going to feel very different in terms of what we have to absorb during that time. It does also raise a question, which I know you've gotten before. I've already gotten it a few times, which is, do we think the Academy is going to keep that late Oscar date?
They're going forward. They've made an announcement that sort of indicates that they're contemplating some kind of Emmy or Globe-like virtual thing where they're going to have multiple locations. They're going to be beaming from not only the Dolby with presumably some kind of host, which hasn't been announced, but other sites presumably around the world. And Soderbergh, one of the producers of the Oscars, we can count on him to come up with something innovative and fun. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, and he's a New Yorker, so I know he's not going to forget about us and whatever live component happens there. So we'll see what happens. But if it works really well, I mean, the question is, does that set a template then for next year? Since even if, as we come out of this pandemic, it's just going to take a long time to figure out how we can start having things the way they used to be, if we even.
One thing that publicists have been telling me, because a lot of people are talking about this, is how is it going to be different when we come out? And a lot of stars are not going to travel.
Yeah, it's too easy to just stay.
They're going to stay home. They're not going to put on their high heels and their tuxes, you know.
But then there are some stars for whom this is a big part of how you stay relevant, right? Is putting on your tux and your high heels and looking good on the red carpet and going to.
Of course, there will be some of it, but a lot of the red carpet is one thing. Junkets are another thing, you know. A lot of the everyday promotion of a movie could now be done from home.
Which, you know, sure, if junkets can be more streamlined for everyone involved, I can't imagine a lot of media are going to complain either, because those things, you know, you sit around in a hotel room for like 3 hours waiting for the talent to show up and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just, may as well simplify that. So in any case, so next week, I don't even know what's going on. We'll have something to
talk about. We'll figure it out, Eric.
We're getting to that point where it's like, I suppose there'll be some more awards related announcements and so forth, but there is.
Actually, we have the WGA next week.
Oh, well, that'll be a good one for us. After SAG.
Always remember that a lot of the movies that aren't on there aren't eligible. So that's part of it. They only nominate the movies that are signatories to the Writers Guild, but we'll talk about that next.
It will definitely give us some indications of some sort. So enjoy your weekend, and I hope that somehow or another you're going to get some rest. It's going to be a nice long one, I know.